the media is extremely powerful, right? They influence so much and give so much information, and so many people rely on it. And it has been shifting over time, especially when it comes to LGBTQ plus and BIPOC folks and our identities and our stories, but it has been very slow. And there has definitely been a lot of resistance. And so when I think of media, I really think about how it is an opportunity, right, for people to really be responsible and accountable on sharing correct information and also dismantling a lot of the oppressive views that we've held, such as when it comes to mental health, right? That many people for a long time thought that when you saw a therapist, you were crazy, right? You were on medication.
Welcome to Latinx in Power, a podcast hosted by Thaisa Fernandes.
Welcome to Latinx in Power. Today, we are talking with Luis Cornejo. Luis is a natural entertainer who enjoys making others laugh and feel inspired. As a licensed marriage and family therapist, Luis works tirelessly to support the LGBTQ+ and BIPOC communities. Luis is the founder of Psychosocial Media, a mental health platform providing mental health articles and resources. He's also an indigenous queer model who has a deep passion for fashion, visibility, and self-expression. In this episode, we'll talk more about Luis' journey into self-expression and mental health. Welcome, Luis.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here and for that wonderful introduction. So, you know, as a therapist in private practice, I do specialize in working with the LGBTQ plus and BIPOC communities. And I work with folks in all different walks of life and different backgrounds and different professions. So exciting to be here and talking with you about mental health in the professional world, but also in general, right? If everyone is impacted by it. So happy to be here.
I'm so excited. This topic, it's very important to me and it's very important to bring into this podcast. So in this episode, we'll talk more about Luis' journey into self-expression and mental health. And first things first, Luis, what does it mean to be a Latinx to you?
Yeah, you know, the word Latinx is so interesting because it's something that has gained traction over the last few years. And most people don't know this, but it was actually a term that was coined in a university, I believe in Puerto Rico. And basically the premise behind it was really to use the word as a way to unify all the collective and different cultures that came as a result of, you know, colonization and all over Latin America and the Caribbean, including Afro-Latinos and, you know, and folks with indigenous roots. It definitely is very controversial. So I will say that, you know, obviously people identify in very different ways when it comes to their identity and the terms that they use. For me, the reason why I use Latinx is because I do like the civility and especially the neutrality when it comes to gender. I do identify as queer. And for me, gender sexuality is very explorative and fluid. And so I like the fact that it includes that. I know a lot of people have very different opinions, right, of whether it's easy to pronounce and not everyone uses it, right? So a lot of folks in Latin America don't use it and actually have a, you know, a bit of a disagreement with the use of the word. So I know it's different for everyone, but, you know, I also identify as Latin, Hispanic, you know, Latino, but I do like the word Latinx just because it does encompass different genders and different ways of reshaping the language. You know, and Spanish is obviously something that was given to folks in Latin America through colonization, and it has shifted and changed and been adapted. So I'm not a big language person who feels like we need to make everything perfect, right? I mean, language is a way we communicate. So for me, being Latinx just means being connected to other people who share a similar history, a similar background, and including folks who don't abide by gender constructs, right, of male, female, but a range. So I think it makes me feel very connected to all groups in very small ways, but also very big ways.
Amazing. Thank you for educating us and like talking more about this. I know it's controversial and I enjoy talking about it. I think language in general, it's so interesting, right? Because especially for us Latinx, that sometimes English is not our first language. Sometimes it is, yeah. But it's also Spanish or Portuguese or many mm-hmm. others. And I love the sense that the language also needs to change, right? It doesn't mean that it is something easy. It doesn't mean that we are going to get right away. Maybe it needs to be built over time. So I really appreciate you talking about that. And I know that's something that sometimes people get pretty mad about it. But yeah. I think like one thing that I talk with people is more about, we are not trying to define how you should be called, but it's more about when you're talking about a group of people, let's try to be inclusive. But when I'm talking about yourself, maybe I know that you prefer to be called Latina. I'm going to call you Latina. I'm not going to change the way you want to be called. But when I'm talking about a group of people, I want to be inclusive. So this is actually something really nice, right? So yeah.
I agree. You know, and you brought up a really good point about language evolving, right? It has changed over time. I mean, a lot of us, we're still trying to figure out how our identity is going to be labeled, right? Because even if you look at the U.S. Census, they don't have Latino or Latina, right? I mean, they have very separate options. And a lot of this is very historical. And so I think as we start to really solidify it and exchange ideas and really come up with ways to identify, it's going to be different and it's going to change. You know, most folks identified as Hispanic and many don't now. You know, they go by Latino, Latinx. I mean, there's power, right, in words. And I think as part of this revolution and also this more empowerment phase for a lot of our communities, there's definitely more intention around wanting to acknowledge and really pay attention to the existence of all people within our communities, right, including Afro-Latinos, Indigenous folks who don't identify oftentimes, at least Indigenous folks don't identify as Latino or Latinx, right? I mean, they're Indigenous, but we, most of us do have, such as myself, right, who also comes from Indigenous, you know, communities, but has lost a lot of the language and knowledge and historical and cultural aspects of it. So for me, it just feels like this is something that allows me to be multiple things. Well, I'm still trying to figure it out, right? Because I, like I mentioned earlier, I identify as indigiqueer, you know, Indigenous and queer. And Latinx oftentimes, like I said, does not sit well with a lot of Indigenous folks. And so for me, it's trying to like also navigate that. So I love that you said, you know, it is evolving, it is changing, and it's complex and complicated. We will keep having these debates and discussions, I think, amongst ourselves.
Yeah, we will. It's so interesting and fascinating with language in general. Like, and I feel now we have a lot more tools, right? We have a lot more words to describe things that we didn't have in the past. So I'm sure we have a lot more in the future. So this is actually very exciting. And Luis, how did everything start?
Yes, I'm originally from Los Angeles, born and raised into a very religious, conservative home. My parents are both immigrants from Mexico and Guatemala, and they got here when they were about 13, 15 years old, respectively. And, you know, they built a life here, bought their home, raised me and my two younger brothers. And a lot of what really led to my career as it is now is really the fact that I didn't have any type of conversations with my family or people that I knew about mental health or what that meant. I saw folks in my family struggle, you know, because a lot of reasons, right? Mostly systemic, right? Whether they were immigrants and were undocumented or whether they were going through relationship issues. And we didn't really talk about them, right? They weren't really named. They weren't things that we discussed or that my parents ever said, you know, this is depression, this is anxiety. They used a lot of religion and that was kind of their focal point for everything, whether talking about mental health from the perspective of, you know, this is the devil, right? Being challenging us or trying to take us a certain route. And so that was kind of their mentality. And I remember how much that really impacted me. And now I'm starting to realize that I did deal with a lot of religious trauma growing up. And a lot of the things that I experienced were often labeled as more religious than they were mental health. And so it was more about your moral character, right? My soul, was I a good person or not? Versus I'm a human being that's struggling with the way that things are, right? Whether it's financial, my parents being poor, or whether it was being queer and coming out. I mean, all of these things that were normal that were not explained to me in that way. And so I think when I went to college, I set off with the intention of wanting to be someone that was helping others. That was always a big thing for me. I saw my parents as Christians helping people all the time, whether it was bringing them into our home or feeding them or donating or, you know, whatever it was, but they were always helping people. And that was a big value that was instilled in me and that I really loved about my parents in general when it came to, you know, the things that they taught us. It was helping others. So I went into college and I thought, you know, I want to be a pediatrician. I want to work with kids. I want to help families. And started taking some bio classes, chem classes. And I was like, oh my God, I hate this. This is not at all what I thought it was going to be. Like I was thinking more of like a people kind of like conversation. And I didn't know about therapy then. So it wasn't like something that I thought like, oh, I could be a therapist. It was more of like, I'm going to help people. I'll be a doctor. And then I looked into law and I was like, I'll be a lawyer. And I was like, I hate this tattoo. I don't like this. And it was kind of going back and forth, kind of figure out what it was that really was calling out to me. And eventually I had a friend who was also a bio major, and she said, hey, you know, I'm looking at this other major. It's called Child and Adolescent Development. And you could do a lot of stuff with it. You could be a teacher, work in administration, and you'd be helping families. And I thought, okay, this sounds a lot more aligned with what I want to do. And I remember after taking a year off, coming back and deciding this is what I want to do. And so I started taking classes, and immediately I fell in love. You know, one of those things where it felt so natural and felt right for me. I was learning about human development, psychology, the education system, the impact of, you know, the government and the family system, all of these amazing concepts. And I remember that was the first time that I started getting straight A's. I fell in love with what I was doing. And towards graduation, I started thinking about like what it was that I actually was going to be doing with this. And the biggest thing was, you know, I can be a teacher. That's something that I think I could totally do. And I ended up teaching and kind of doing a little bit more like research too, and parent work in early, that I had started was a development center. And so I worked with children from 0 to 5 years old, and I loved it. I was there for about 3 years. I did a lot of observations and talk to parents about developmental milestones and psychology, and think about long-term, like, you know, this is great. I love this, but I also want to do more work individually. And, you know, working with parents wasn't the biggest part of my role. And so it started to become something that I loved. And I started to look at different careers. You know, I was exploring and kind of thinking, what can I do? What's out there? And I had a co-worker who was a teacher who was also going to graduate school. And she was telling me, you should think about social work. And I was like, social work? Like, what is that? And for me, when I thought of social work, I always thought of like the people that like, you know, took kids to foster care or like did something that was like agents of the government. And I was like, oh, like, I don't know if that's what I want to do. But I started researching it. And then I noticed that they had a lot of other titles and fields out there that were very much aligned with similar values to social work, but were more about individual one-on-one family work. And so I started to look at getting a PsyD, you know, becoming a psychologist or a licensed professional counselor. And then I saw the LMFT, which is licensed marriage and family therapist title. And it really spoke out to me because one, it included all these different modalities that I really wanted to work with, which were like children and parents and couples and individuals. And the more and more I read about it, it was very focused on doing the work that I was really setting out to do. And so as I was, you know, thinking about applying, I was still living in San Francisco. I was with my partner after we were together for about 4 or 5 years at that point. And I told him, hey, you know what? Like, I think this is what I want to do. I think I'm going to apply. And he was like, yeah, like, go for it. You know, where are you thinking of applying? And the only school that I really liked that spoke out to me was in LA, you know, where I'm originally from. At that point, I had been living in San Francisco for a few years. So I was kind of dreading the idea of going back home to LA and all of this stuff. But I told myself, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to apply. If I get in, that's a sign and I'll go. I'm not one for magical thinking or like, oh, if it happens, you know, luck or whatever. But I think I told myself, like, I'm going to allow myself to just be hopeful. And if it does work now, then I'll do it. And if not, I'm fine as a teacher. So I applied and, you know, I told myself, you know, I'm going to let it go because I don't know if I'm actually going to get in, right? These are very competitive programs. This was a great school with a good reputation. And I sat back, didn't think about it. And then I got a call and they told me, hey, you know what? We got your application. We got about 350 applications. We're only interviewing 50 people. And we want to invite you to be one of the people. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I remember telling my partner, oh my God, they picked me. Like, they want me to go interview. And we were both so excited. I remember telling my parents, I was the first one in my family and extended family to go to undergraduate and finish and get my 4-year degree. And I was going to be the first person to get a master's degree if I got in. So it was a lot of pressure, but also excitement. And I remember telling my parents, like, you know, this is my interview. I'm going to be in LA. And they were like, we're going to go with you. And my parents are those people that are very supportive and very traditional, but they've always shown up for me. They've always been there. And I remember picking them up and they're dressed in their church outfits, like they're going to church. And they're like, let's go to this interview. And I'm like, okay, we drove there. I'm sitting there. I'm the only one at the interview. There's like 8 people. I'm the only one with their parents there, like this little kid with their little briefcase, just kind of, you know, sitting there. And I think for me, that was always something that was very powerful, was that my cultura and at least my upbringing, there was a lot around family being supportive and helpful of one another. And obviously, I mean, that comes with a lot of other things. But I think one thing I will say is that with my parents, they've always shown up for me in that way. And so they got there, we were sitting there. I went into my interview. I was so nervous. And I remember just a couple questions wanting to get to know me. And the biggest question that they asked that I almost felt like I messed up was, why why do you want to be a therapist? And I remember sitting there thinking like, I don't know, like, because I want to help people. They're like, well, what's your experience, you know, with mental health? And like I had mentioned earlier, I had never talked about it. I wasn't exposed to it. So in my head, it was like, you know, I heard the word, but to me, it was like, I didn't understand them to that degree. I thought the same, like many other people do now. Oh, it's all in our heads, you know, oh, it's just about our attitude, yada, yada. And at that point, I remember sitting there thinking, you know, I just really want to help people. And I've had friends who've struggled, who have talked to me about their disorders, you know, whether bipolar or having depression, and I've seen how it impacts them. And I want to learn more. And I want to be someone that can be there for other people, because I didn't have anyone who was there for me when I was growing up. And I left thinking like, okay, yeah, I messed it up. You know, they're not going to call me. And I went to San Francisco. And maybe like a couple weeks later, my parents had visited us and we took them out to eat Chinese food in downtown San Francisco. And I was sitting there and I get a call and it's an unknown number. And I tell my partner, he's sitting with my parents, and I'm like, I'll be right back. Walked outside and I answered the phone and it's a woman. And she goes, hi, Luis. Like, I am calling from, you know, so-and-so. And I just wanted to let you know that we had a very competitive, you know, pool of applicants this year. We had 350. We only interviewed 50 people and we're only going to take 23 people. And I just want to let you know that you're one of them. And I started to cry. I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah, we wanted to let you know that you got accepted. And well, we want to know if you're coming. And I think I sat there like just kind of like crying. And she was asking me, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. Like, I'm okay. And yes, I'll go. And she was like, okay, great. Well, we'll send you stuff to come for orientation. And I'm walking back in and my partner's like, what's going on? Like, are you okay? And he knew I was waiting to hear from the call. And so I think he didn't know I was crying. So he was like, did he get in? Did he not get in? And I sat down and I still had tears in my eyes. And I looked up at my parents and I told them in Spanish, like, I got it. And I just remember my mom like being so excited and like kind of crying. And too, like, she was very misty-eyed. And my dad was a typical like, man, like, oh, I'm proud of you. Like, I knew you could do this. And, you know, I gave them a hug and my partner was really excited. And I went to grad school a couple months after. And that was the first time I was exposed to therapy. And it was because part of the requirement was that I needed to go to therapy. And so I remember being in therapy for the first time and thinking, this is what I'm going to be doing. And also feeling so much anxiety about talking to a stranger. And I was very fortunate that I worked with a Latina woman as my first therapist. Helped me so much and really was very patient with me, but also challenged me a lot around the things that I thought that I knew and that I believed about myself, about my family. And I've been to at least 4 therapists since. I'm in therapy now. I'm a big believer in it. I think that we use it and need it at different times in our lives. You know, it's not something that we have to always be in, but it is something that can help us. And that's where everything really changed for me and shifted. And it was through getting through grad school, loving it, getting straight A's, getting a scholarship after I finished. I mean, those were all signs for me, like, this is where I need to be, you know, at least academically. Then as I ventured out into the world, I ended up working with families, which was really difficult. That first year, I almost ended up telling myself, maybe I did make the wrong choice. You know, I was on call 24/7. The system was definitely not very well equipped to support people with mental health issues, especially in the foster system and foster families. So it was a bit of a hurdle my first year. But I remember my supervisor telling me, you know, once you get past this year, you are going to be able to handle anything. And everything since then has been, I think, a stairway into what I'm doing now. You know, I worked in hospitals, I worked in nonprofits, I worked with different populations, and now I'm in private practice. You know, now I've seen the clients that I want to work with, who also are very well intentioned in terms of what they want to do in therapy, who understand a lot of the nuances about how the work happens, you know, and understand that it is a process. And I do specialize in working with queer and, you know, BIPOC folks. And, you know, so that has been very rewarding for me. And I think all of those little things really led to that part where I'm at now. And so owning my own business, being first generation, being bilingual, being queer, and then also taking the time to make this role something where I love the work I'm doing, but I'm also paying attention to other parts of myself. So I do model. I've done modeling for a few designers in San Francisco. I've walked a couple shows. I've done photo shoots for a big company for some of their own internal stuff that they do. That was my first paid job last month. It was very exciting. I'm continuing to find opportunities and really put myself out there. And all of that has been thanks to the work that I've done, you know, because for me, being a therapist is not just about a career or a profession. And I don't like to hide behind the idea of being a therapist. I like to show up as an authentic person who is also dealing with their own stuff, who's also working through their own things. And so that's why I do specialize in helping people with self-expression, with their forming their identity, coming to terms with some of their limiting beliefs and dismantling that. And so I work from a lens of really decolonizing and moving away from traditional therapy, where it's very much not just we're talking, but I'm here for you. We're two human beings. I'm also someone that is living out in the world. And how do we co-create space together, right? Rather than you coming in and me telling you, these are your symptoms, you're sick. This is what's wrong with you. That to me, that it's just not what I do. For me, it's really about co-creating and using myself as a human being in someone else's healing. It's an art. It definitely takes time, but that's where I'm at now. And I definitely love what I'm doing at the moment.
Amazing. Your story is incredible. I got a little emotional and yeah, you're incredible. You're incredible. I love how you often talk about how media plays a massive role in the way mental health is perceived and understood. And before I saw you talking about that, to be honest, I didn't do this connection before. So I'd love if you can talk more about that with us today.
Yeah, in terms of, the media, for me, I love entertainment. I'm someone that grew up with different shows that meant different things to me and music and, someone where most of the information we got was from watching the Spanish, channel news in the evening. And something that I've learned over my career and just over my lifetime is that the media is extremely powerful, right? They influence so much and give so much information and so many people rely on it. And it has been shifting over time, especially when it comes to LGBTQ+ and BIPOC folks and our identities and our stories, but it has been very slow. And there has definitely been a lot of resistance. And so when I think of media, I really think about how it is an opportunity, right, for people to really be responsible and accountable on sharing correct information and also dismantling a lot of the oppressive views that we've held, such as when it comes to mental health, right? That many people for a long time thought that when you saw a therapist, you were crazy, right? You were on medication. You were in a crisis. You were unstable because that's what we saw on TV. That's what we saw on TV shows. That's what we saw novelas in the news. Mental health was often used as an scapegoat by the media. And over the years, it's definitely changed where there's more awareness and an understanding of how mental health plays a role, but yet it's still not enough, right? We still see a lot of use of mental health for dramatic, aspects of movies, of the news. Whenever someone, there's a shooting, people talk about mental health. And I mean, there's a confusion around how mental health impacts us, but also people who are expressing that they're struggling with mental health issues. And the reality is that we all have mental health. This is not a, who's struggling or who's not. This is, we all have it. Mental health is just like physical health. We all experience different illnesses at different times, whether it's anxiety and being extremely worried and not being able to sleep for weeks, for months, to depression, where we just feel so heavy and tired and, negative thoughts and low self-esteem and inability to focus, all of these different things that happen to us, right, that are for prolonged periods of time. Whether it is short-term, a few weeks or long-term years, we all deal with mental strain at some point or another. And so the media is now, I think, realizing that people are normalizing going to therapy. They're normalizing talking about their mental health challenges. They're normalizing the understanding that we are impacted by systems, the government, financial, political, right? I mean, all of these different things that they do affect us. I'm also discussing more around our identities and taking into account our intersectionalities, right, around our gender, our background, our age, all of these different things, our ethnicity. And so it is shifting. And, the media definitely has a lot of responsibility in how they not just give out information, but also how they normalize these things. And so, like I mentioned, we're seeing more and more. I've actually done a few media appearances on Telemundo, which is a big Spanish network, where I talked a bit about different mental health topics like anxiety, LGBTQ issues, something that I definitely love to do. I think it's important to share information, but also to help folks dismantle a lot of that shame, right? Or at least understand where the shame is coming from and learn to really navigate being able to ask for help. And I think the other part to this too, with the media shifting and being a lot more open, but also more aware, right, of how this is helping people, it's bringing up a lot of the other issues like accessibility, right? Most of the time I hear people tell me now, well, now we know that therapy is good. Now we know that it's okay, but it's expensive. I don't have insurance. I can't find a therapist in my area. I don't have someone that, you know, is queer or a person of color. How do I, you know, go to therapy now that I know it's good? And so it's bringing this up, right? It's bringing awareness that now we also have a very flawed system, right? People don't have access. People, you know, cannot afford it, you know, and I've met many wonderful therapists and, you know, also myself who are doing their best to try to find ways to accommodate and help. And at the same time, this is our livelihood, right? I mean, we have to live from what we make doing this work. And while it is important and very helpful, I think that also speaks volumes, right, to the way that the system is flawed, that us as therapists may not be able to sustain ourselves, but we're still expected to sacrifice ourselves, right, for people. And so for me, I struggle with that a bit here and there, just really trying to grasp how a lot of this is way bigger than me, right? Being able to offer cheaper fees or what is it, a sliding scale, but that it's really more systemic, right? That even our medical insurance companies, I mean, it's awful here, right? When we talk about medical insurance and even to get that kind of help for physical, more visual stuff, mental health is even harder. So for me, you know, and other folks that I've met, like I was mentioning earlier, we offer sliding scale. We offer, you know, other opportunities like groups. We do things where we try to work with clients and giving them lower fees for until they can get back on their feet, but it's not enough. And I think it's important to acknowledge that this is a systemic problem. This is something that is still affecting all of us because the lack of accessibility and the lack of focus and importance being placed on mental health is still not where it needs to be. And the media can play a big role in that, right? And really bringing attention to the disparity in mental health access and really showcasing that mental health is not just about people being in a crisis or suicidal, but that it's people struggling with work stress, people dealing with relational stuff, because all of those things are going to impact us. So for me, that's kind of my thing with the media, you know, and so it's also the reason why I'm moving myself and aligning myself a lot more into doing more media work, whether it's using social media, whether it's doing the news, whether it's venturing into modeling, into all of these things to talk about how, you know, we're all impacted in different ways. For me, modeling and fashion was something that helped me heal and really learn to love and express myself and work through a lot of my own body issues that I also experienced and had to let go of. And it's allowed me to feel empowered. And that's why I do a lot of these things, not just for myself, but also to showcase that we are human beings. We need creativity. We find healing in so many different ways, while at the same time also advocating that we need to change the accessibility. We need to talk more about therapy for folks who are not in crisis or suicidal. And we need to normalize this on TV for the people that still, you know, don't have that knowledge or who are still watching something and thinking, I'm not going to therapy. That's for crazy people. I'm not taking medication. That's for crazy people. And instead seeing people who look like them and who don't look like them, but still saying like, hey, I struggle too. And I've had postpartum depression after giving birth. I've had, you know, anxiety. I've dealt with trauma. And how do I find help? And for it to be available.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love your journey. And I would love to talk more about the self-expression part. And I love when you said that as well. And like making that connection, something new to me. When we talked before this episode, you shared how self-expression can help your mental health journey. And I would love if you can dive a little bit deeper into that, because I thought this is very interesting.
Yeah. You know, self-expression is a very powerful word to me, because growing up, I often felt like I didn't have that opportunity. You know, I shared earlier that I grew up in a very religious home. And so a lot of the things that were expected of me were very much conservative values, the way that I dressed, the way that my hair was, the way that I acted and presented myself. It was very, very scrutinized, but also very micromanaged by my parents. Understandably so. You know, I think for them, it was really about keeping me safe and having me protected in that way, right? Where I was a respectful, you know, whatever, young man and all this stuff. And that was kind of their mentality. But what that did for me was that it really kept me from shining and showing myself and being myself. You know, I often felt like I couldn't like the things that I liked or be interested in the things that I was, like fashion or even my hair styling or anything like that, because it was not okay. So self-expression, I mean, to me, it means so many things. It's not just about clothing. It's about our personality. It's about who we are. And I did feel for a long time that that was very at bay for me. You know, I wasn't allowed to be funny the way that I wanted or to do a lot of the things that I wanted because it was, you know, considered inappropriate, or it was just something that I think it was a lot of conditioning. As I grew up and started to really sit with myself more, I struggled a lot with trying to figure out who I was, what I wanted in life, because a lot of it was anxiety that was from my upbringing and my parents and their own anxiety about how I was supposed to be and show up in the world. And it wasn't until about 3 years ago, almost maybe like a little bit before the pandemic, that I remember starting my private practice, or at least planning to start it, and telling myself, I don't want to do this anymore, where I'm showing up to these places, these professional spaces or whatever, and being something that I'm not. I don't feel comfortable in the clothes I wear. I don't feel comfortable in the way that I talk. I don't feel comfortable having to code switch and talk like I'm this, you know, whatever, and feel shame and guilt when I mispronounce a word, when I, you know, share an idea that people don't understand. And I told myself, if I'm going to do this and do my own business, I need to do this my way, and I need to show up for myself. And it was really the idea around not being able to find a space at the table and creating that for myself, by creating my own space and saying, I'm going to finally give myself a chance. And I took the risk. And I remember I woke up one day and I told my partner, you know, I've always wanted to do more with fashion. And he laughed, because when we started dating, I would make shirts for him. So I would design quote unquote shirts, and I would make them. I used glue guns and all this stuff, and he would wear them, which was really sweet. Now, when I look back, some of them weren't that cute or anything, but he was so supportive that he would wear them. And I remember him telling me, you've always been creative. You've always been someone that wanted to express themselves, and you did it in little ways, but it was always to other people. And I noticed you've always wanted to do that for yourself. And that really resonated with me, and it really hit me hard, because it was one of those moments where I was like, you're right. Like, that is who I am. And I've held it in so long because I didn't think I was good enough, because I didn't think I was thin enough, because I didn't think I was attractive enough or light-skinned enough or whatever it was, all of these things. And that moment for me was so revolutionary, because it gave me an opportunity to sit back and think of, what are the things that I've wanted to do? And I remember telling my partner that same day, I think I want to try makeup. And he looked at me, he was like, yeah, like you could do it. And I asked him, can you go to the store with me today? And I remember going to the store for the first time. It was a MAC makeup store. And I was standing there and I see all these lipsticks and all these things. And I'm sitting there like, oh my God, I know what these things are, but I've never used them. And I've always been curious about using them. And not because it was like, oh, you know, I want to do this, blah, blah, blah. It was because I always found that to be such a magical thing for people to be so creative, you know, to express themselves in color, you know, something that's even historical, right? Because even in Europe, monarchs, right? Kings use makeup, blush, powders, all this stuff. And so I told my partner, like, I want to try it. And we were there and I was looking at a lipstick and he was helping me put it on. And I remember one of the ladies coming over, she's like, oh, do you need any help? And I was like, no, I'm just looking. And she's like, oh, I have a good color for you. And that feeling of being welcomed and not questioned or looked at weird was so nice to me. It was this moment of like, oh my God, these people, like, they're not looking or judging me. They're like, let me help you. And I remember leaving with a few things and trying it out at home. And I was so messy at first. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get the hang of this. My partner was like, look it up, you know, reach out to one of your friends that does. And I had a lot of queer friends who were already doing their makeup. And I remember reaching out, and it took a bit of time, but it ended up starting to really like it. And like, now I know what I like, what I don't, you know, I don't wear a lot of expressed makeup like I did when I first started, but at least it allowed me to explore that. So I could decide I didn't like certain things. And now I'm more of like my natural, I like more like skin tone stuff because it makes me feel good. And so I wear that. And at the same time, I was also exploring with fashion. And I've always been one of those people when that their heart's out to something, you know, they do their best, right? I mean, they give it their all. And if it doesn't work out, fine. But if it does, it's, you know, obviously it was part of that work that, you know, that you do. And so I started to pick out clothing, and I had a really hard time because for much of my life, men's clothing never felt comfortable to me. A lot of it just really felt very plain, but also just felt like I was being constricted. And I remember thinking, maybe I can try more feminine or women's clothing or whatever. And there was a lot of shame for me in opening up to it, because I kept thinking, like, you know, what does that mean about me? What does that say about me? And this was also a process that I went through myself. You know, I started to shop and try things on, and it was a lot of experimenting. There was a point where I was like, okay, yeah, this is definitely not something that I would wear. This is definitely something I would. And I started to really show up for myself. And I think the biggest change was that I actually didn't do this at home. I was going out. I was like, I'm going out with my friends. I'm going out with my partner. And I was dressed that way. And my partner has always been extremely supportive. And so he was one of the people that made me feel so comfortable that he always would just, you look great. Or, oh, let me fix this for you. Or, oh, you know what? I didn't really like that top. What about this one? But always so supportive in that way. And so that was my biggest worry at first. It was like, oh, how's my partner going to feel? You know, seeing me change after almost 13 years together, right? How is he going to feel? And I remember that level of safety was so motivational for me, because it made me feel like I'm doing some healing work here. I'm with someone that loves me and cares for me, and they're saying it's okay, versus what I had when I was younger, where it was like, no, don't walk like that. Don't dress like that. Don't use this. And so it was a big change. And I have to say that even with clothing, I experimented so much, and eventually I landed on styles that felt good to me, that I consider more non-binary, right, than men or women's clothing. Because honestly, at the end of the day, they're clothing. And people can look great. And I used to hate when people would say, oh, that's for women though, I can't wear that. And it was like, but you look so good in it. And it doesn't even, what is it that makes it women's clothing? Oh, you know, it's the material, it's too soft. And I'm like, okay, you know, places like Versace, like Gucci, they use a lot of like these silk stuff. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, unless you're really wealthy, you're not exposed to. And a lot of people kind of feel like with fashion, it needs to look a certain way if you're male, right? Be rugged or be like very like thick material. And I was like, I hate that. I want to feel something soft. I want to feel good in what I'm wearing. And so I started to find things that were mixed between all of it. And that was something that was definitely a big game changer for me, that now I show up for myself. I do professional things in clothing that feels comfortable for me. I express myself in other ways too, because of the fact that now I'm not worried or scared, because I'm like, well, if people see me, I have nothing to worry about. I'm going to say what I think. And so it also led to me expressing myself verbally more, sharing my ideas. If you were talking to me 3 years ago, I probably would have been really anxious right now talking about these things. I probably would have not been able to express what I'm trying to say, had a lot of imposter syndrome. But because I really learned to let go of those things by allowing myself and giving myself permission to go through this process, which was not always easy, I feel a lot more in my body. I feel a lot more in my mind, and I definitely feel free. And so that's why I think I'm in a place now where I can share this and talk to people and encourage people when it comes to self-expression. You know, and I don't mean we have to go out and have all these colors on or dress or whatever. What I'm saying is, how can you be yourself and show up for yourself and feel good about yourself and your body and your skin tone and who you are and your, you know, even culture, whatever it is, but showing up in all of these spaces and bringing that with you. So it's something that has made a difference for me. And I think self-expression is not just clothing, it's everything, right? It's the way that we show up.
Yes. I feel that I could talk with you for hours and hours and hours. You're like talking about a lot of very, very interesting things that I want to bring to this podcast. And thinking about 6 years ago, I probably will never have a podcast in my second language. I love this conversation about self-expression. Again, I don't think it's something that we talk often. And I feel one thing that folks might be thinking is this idea, like what it means to be professional, right? If I use certain things, like, and I'm still being professional. And I would like to challenge that. And let's talk about what it means to be professional.
Absolutely.
In a work environment, Luis.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think all of us deal with that, right? Because we live in a system that does reinforce this idea of what professional and worthy means, right? That we need to dress a certain way and act a certain way. And yes, many of those things, while applicable, right? Obviously, our behaviors at work are important, right? I'm not going to be a therapist and sitting with someone and on my phone, right? That's obviously non-helpful. What I'm saying when I talk about professionalism and dismantling that is really the idea around feeling like, one, we need to token switch, right? Which is it's really the idea around how we are in real life, right? Around the world, and then how we show up at work and having to speak a certain way and be aligned with certain things. And that's often not helpful, right? I know for me, I discovered that there were so many moments where I didn't understand certain things, or I didn't really know how to ask for something. And I felt like, well, it's a professional thing. I shouldn't say anything. I need to keep quiet and figure it out on my own, or it's going to make me look a certain way. To where I switched that and thought, if they want me to do my job, I want to do a good job. I need to be able to ask questions. I need to feel safe enough to be able to express myself and also give my opinions and my feedback, you know, when I'm asked for it. I also need to not worry about the way that I say certain words sometimes. You know, people need to clarification. I can explain it to them, but not letting myself fall into that shame of I need to be quiet because I'm going to sound stupid, or I'm going to sound like this or that. And acknowledging that it's amazing that I speak two languages and I'm going to mess up here and there. And that's okay. So moving away from a lot of those things, dress-wise as well, the idea of dressing up and being uncomfortable has always bothered me. I think a lot of places, especially tech places, have moved away from that. Very, very much so, you know, where a lot of businesses are still very much like suit and tie, you know, or you have to dress, what is it, business casual or whatever. And, you know, people, a lot of people are great with that, but there's many of us who don't feel comfortable in that. And I'm talking specifically also about folks who are non-binary or who don't fit into those areas, that they're often forced to have to dress a certain way or have their hair a certain way. You know, Black women dealt with this for a very long time where they were told that their hair needed to be a certain way, professional presentation. And now it's like, no, that's not something that keeps us from doing our job, right? It's something that allows us to show up and let our natural, you know, traits be shown. So I think for me also, that is a part of it, right? How we show up. But the other bigger part of really moving away from professionalism is a lot of what's instilled, the values, right? The competitiveness, the secrets around salary, the policies that are often rooted in patriarchy around, you know, the way that women are paid and the way they can express themselves and the way that men move up in the professional ladder. I mean, all of these little things that are not good for us, right? They keep us from allowing people to be able to do this work in a way that makes more sense, right? People who may not have had the privilege of going to a lot of these big universities, but are still very intelligent, very creative. It dismantles a lot of that, those systems, right? That do continue to oppress people, even in the professional world, you know, and I've dealt with that myself as a therapist as well, applying and working in certain companies and places where there was a lot of emphasis on how we were supposed to present ourselves and things that we could say and not say. Most of my career, I was told, don't talk about yourself. Don't share anything with clients. Don't be very firm. You know, you're a blank slate. You don't react. And for me, that was always one of the harder things, thinking like, how am I supposed to have people coming in, being vulnerable for the first time, wanting to find a space where they can talk? And I'm sitting there looking like someone that has no problems, that is telling them what's wrong with them and then telling them what to do. Like, it just didn't make sense to me. You know, the idea of healing and therapy are very old, old, old ideas that we have been doing as a society forever, supporting one another, having people that we talk to, doing rituals and cultural healing practices. You know, whether it was Native American practices or practices in other places across the world. And so for me, it was like, it doesn't make sense. You cannot professionalize something that involves people in this way, right? Where we're not showing up, you're not being seen. So moving away from that was really important for me and letting go of it. And, you know, obviously it doesn't mean that I threw everything away, right? I still abide very much by law and ethics to my practice. And at the same time, I've also found a way to, I say artistically, because I think it definitely takes time for you to find your way and find your own process, but you find moments and opportunities to shift away from a lot of these things. You know, for me, one of the biggest things was diagnosing folks. I'll tell them, I will give you a diagnosis if that's what you need, if it's insurance, if you need to hear it, but I'm not here to tell you that there's something wrong with you. And I'm not here to tell you that you're sick. And I'm not here to tell you that I'm going to fix you because you're not broken. You know, I'm here to sit with you, process these things, give you information, give you the ability to use the things that you already have without those blocks, without the self-limiting beliefs, without the uncontrollable anxiety, the things that are standing in the way. And so for me, that has been very important. And if I had stayed on the whole professionalism route, I don't think I'd be doing the work or supporting my clients in the best way possible. And so I think this is applicable to all professions, right? In different ways, but at the same time, still very relevant.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I love that. To me, like being professional is being able to do your job, collaborate with your colleagues, being kind, you know, like being able to ask the difficult questions, but in a really nice way and have difficult conversations. This is very, very, very important, right? In a work environment, it's not just agreeing to your colleagues, but also like being able to challenge some ideas and create something better after that. This is what it means to be professional, right? So I love that. And we are getting to the end of this episode. I absolutely loved everything that you talked, and I love if you can share more.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. A couple of books that I love. One is The Body Keeps Score, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard about. Yeah, I love that book. And so I want to make sure people, you know about that book. Look it up if you haven't heard about it. I just think it's a very powerful book that really helps make that connection between, you know, mind and body and how it impacts us, you know, the experiences we go through. Another book is called The Velvet Rage, Growing Up Gay in a Straight Man's World. It's a really wonderful book. There's not a lot of books out there about the gay experience or even the mental health aspects, but I really love that book because it helped me in my journey as a gay man, but also really leading up to moving away from identifying as gay into queer, because it talked a lot about the experiences of being a boy growing up in a very patriarchal system and how that affects us and a lot of the things related to that relationship, sexuality. That's another really great book. And in terms of podcasts, the Latinx Therapy podcast is a wonderful one. It's run by one of my dear friends, Adriana Alejandre, who talks about so many different topics as well, ranging from the Latinx perspective, mental health. So that's a great one.
Where people can find you?
People can find me on social media. So I'm more active on Instagram. My Instagram handle is at the, you know, the little A, and then Luis, L-U-I-S underscore D. T-H-E-E underscore, and then L-M-F-T. And so that's for Luis, the licensed marriage and family therapist. That's where people can find me. I also have a website if people are interested in therapy and they're in California. That website is www.psychosocial.com. And then for psychosocial media, which is the website where I do have articles from different therapists and some resources, that one is www.psychosocial.media. And so you can find a lot of my stuff there. And then I also have my personal website, which I'll share with everyone. That's more for the modeling. So you can see the work I've done, some of the campaigns and photos. That one is www.luis, the little, I don't even know what that thing is called. There's a little line in the middle, not the underscore, but the middle line, and then Cornejo, Cornejo.com.
Amazing. We are going to link to the description of the episode, the books Perfect. You mentioned, and all the places people can find you. Thank you. Thank you so, so, so much, Luis.
Of course. Thank you. So happy that I was able to have this conversation, and I appreciate you asking some really awesome questions.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's it for today, everyone. Thank you so much for your time. We'll have more episodes coming, and I hope you enjoyed it. Feel free to share this episode with friends and family, and we'll see each other soon. Thank you.